In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Michael Shermer. He's a columnist for Scientific American. He is the author of a number of books, including Why People Believe Weird Things, How We Believe, and the Science of Good and Evil. He's also the publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He is the executive director of the Skeptics Society and host of the Skeptics Lecture Series at the California Institute of Technology. And someone who is widely interviewed on radio and television about science, about how it is that science helps us understand the world. And he's the author of a collection of pieces. These are actually pieces, previously published pieces, but now have been gathered together into a book that's come out fairly recently titled Science Friction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown. It's published by Times Books. He has a bachelor's degree in psychology from Pepperdine, master's in experimental psych from Cal State Fullerton, has PhD in the history of science from Claremont Graduate School. The titles that I mentioned, just a few of his books. If you're interested in finding out more about the skeptics, you can search him out on the web. And on the website of Scientific American, you can also read some of his past columns there for the magazine. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Shermer, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, great to be on.
We certainly appreciate it. The place I guess maybe I thought I'd start, appropriately enough, since your association with the Skeptic Society and with the magazine, and it is something that you write about in the book. There's a piece on this subject in the book. Maybe you could talk about what it means to be a skeptic.
Right. Well, skepticism is just a way of thinking. It's really science. It's the scientific method. So we can speak of science and skepticism or skeptic in the same vein, that it's not a thing. Don't think of science as a thing or skeptic as a position you take, like, ooh, I'm a skeptic, which means I don't believe anything. That's impossible. You have to believe all kinds of things in order to just get by in life. So really it's just an approach to claim. Science and skepticism is just asking, what's the evidence? What's the quality of the evidence? Who's making the claim? Has the claim been tested? Are there biases involved? You know, that sort of thing. So, like, for example, we've seen some stuff about David Irving and the Holocaust deniers in the news recently. And, you know, when we first investigated them, I wrote a whole book about them called Denying History, and we did a special issue of Skeptic on them. And, you know, they were skeptics. They said, well, we're skeptical that the Holocaust happened. So I did an investigation of them, and I ended up being skeptical of the skeptics in that case. So I was, I guess you'd say, a true believer or a believer in the Holocaust, and they're skeptics. So that's a nice example of skepticism being a relative thing. It depends on the particular claim that you're going to be skeptical about or believe in.
One thing I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about is the way that people think about science. And I ask the question because it seems to me that, generally speaking, scientists are pretty honest folks in the sense that they will be pretty upfront with you about what they know, what they don't know, the fact that they actually could be wrong, that if something comes along, they get new data, they get new information, they get new experiments that says some of the previous ideas were incorrect. A good scientist should stand up and say, you know what, we were wrong about that. This is what we think now. But, you know, next week we could have new information and that could change. And the thing is that I sometimes think that people regard that as being a weakness of science, and I would expect that you and other people would argue, in fact, that is the strength of science.
Yeah, in fact, I think it's science's greatest strength. It's not that scientists as humans are more moral or honest than any other profession. They're not. It's that the system of science itself has a self-correcting mechanism built into it, a machinery that requires you to ferret out your own errors and mistakes and biases. Because if you don't, somebody else will, and they'll do it with great glee, because that's part of the scientific method, is to debunk other people's claims. And, you know, when somebody makes an outlandish claim or claims to have results from an experiment, you know, that's pretty far out there. You know, some cure for cancer, that coffee causes cancer, or some such thing like that. Labs will rush out to try to duplicate the results, and if they can't, they will gleefully publish that negative result. So There's a pressure on scientists to make sure they go way out of their way to be honest about their data and how they collected it, and to try to debunk themselves or at least get their colleagues down the hall to do it for them before they go into print. And that's one of the things that gives me confidence in science, particularly in areas that I don't know much about, like when we're dealing with esoteric ideas like string theory and inflationary cosmology and these kinds of physical theories that I don't really know the math at all on. I have to trust in my my colleagues down at Caltech, for example, that they're checking each other. And it's not that I have faith or I blindly believe. It's that I know that science has that built-in self-correcting machinery, that those guys are going to be hammering away at each other to make sure that they're on the right track, so I can have some confidence that what they tell me then has some basis in truth.
Well, I'm still kind of curious about the popular image of science and why it is that people have this idea that somehow, because scientists periodically they do come forward and they say, well, you know, what we thought last week is not what we think this week, and we might think next. Why do people think that somehow means
all crazy? Doesn't it?
Yeah, well,
wait,
yeah.
Wait a minute. Last year I thought I was supposed to eat fruits. Now I'm not. Now I'm supposed to eat protein. What's the deal here?
Well, it's it could be that, or it could be the Big Bang, or it could be, you know,
right.
It could be anything.
Right. And so what are we supposed to think? Well, okay, the fact is that the evidence is always changing, so we have to keep an open mind. Base our decisions on provisional truths that are true for now, provisionally, for a while, until something changes that, you know, we agree that this is probably the case, and we'll operate on that fact until something else changes it. And that is science's weakness and its greatest strength. And I think instead of seeing it as just a weakness without the strength, just see it as both. That, yeah, okay, it's just the way it is. It's not like art or science or literature or even politics, where you have ideologies and principles that you start off from and then base everything you do on those and you never change them. Science is the opposite, at least in theory. You just keep gathering evidence and change your ideologies and principles based on that changing evidence. And I think that's a huge plus in terms of making you more tolerant about other people's beliefs, because it forces you to say, well, I could be wrong. I wish more politicians were willing to change their minds when evidence came in. Occasionally you'll see a senator or a congressman change parties, but it's so rare it makes the news. It's a huge story when one of them changes parties. And it takes a lot of intellectual courage to do it, but the system is not built to encourage that. In fact, the system is built to encourage just the opposite of stability and non-change.
Well, you use the words conditional, provisional truth, I think. And I guess that's the thing I think that probably a lot of people are uncomfortable. How does one learn to become comfortable with provisional truth?
Yeah, it takes a little getting used to. I mean, the normal temptation we all have is to be uncomfortable with uncertainty. And in science, it's okay to say, I don't know. And so I'm fond of saying there is no such thing as the paranormal or the supernatural. There's just the normal, the natural, and mysteries we have yet to explain. And for a lot of things, it's just okay to say, I don't know. Maybe nobody knows right now. Maybe we'll figure it out later. But cognitive dissonance tells us that the mind is uncomfortable with that uncertainty. We like final truths. It's one of the appealing aspects of religion. It's offering final absolute truths. And scientists say, well, there aren't any absolute truths. There's provisional truths. And that makes a lot of people uncomfortable, I think.
We have a caller. We'd bring him into the conversation right now. And someone listening this morning over in Indiana on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to ask you one question that deals with something that seems to be getting much larger now, and it concerns me, and that's the assault on evolution.
Yes.
And the I'm retired now, and I used to teach, and I remember a number of people who come to me and ask me certain things, and the minute I said certain things, and they said, well, scientists don't know anything. They're all the time saying that their last theory was wrong. And you know, so there seems to be this tendency for absoluteness. And I think a lot of them psychologically, you know, fill into that. But I was wondering if you happen, you know, are up to it, or in a sense know what the latest thing is going on, is what parts of the, let's say, the theory now, are they attacking? I never see anything in their dispositions about, you know, any science, really. It's just that, well, these guys haven't figured that out, and these guys haven't figured that out, so then and the whole thing to them collapses into, you know, all started in 5004 or whenever it was, and you know, and presumably now I think they're getting into these, which I guess the community, the scientific community itself is studying, is that the sudden movement of evolution, you know, through a smaller period of time than, say, a long period of time. I was just wondering what they consider weaknesses and what they're attacking. And even Bush has got into it and said, well, evolution's not a fact, which shows a misunderstanding of what theories is, too.
Well, these are good observations.
We're really at a disadvantage.
So let's just go ahead and start from the beginning of evolution's not a fact. Well, of course it's not a fact. There are no facts in science in terms of what we think of as proven 100%. There are theories, and there are well-founded theories and not-so-well-founded theories and hypotheses and so on. And the theory of evolution is probably one of the half-dozen most well-supported theories in the history of all of science. And so we have a great deal of confidence that it's true, that the theory that life evolved, descent with modification from organisms in the past till today, and we know this through so many independent lines of inquiry that converge to this conclusion, in which different scientists working in different fields who don't know each other, they don't talk to each other, they don't go to the same conferences, they publish in different journals, independently of one another, come up with the same conclusion. So for there to be, say, a mistake or an error by some evolutionary biologist, that would not bring down the theory. So an intelligent design creationist say, oh, look, we found a flaw or a hole or a gap in science, the knowledge of science, therefore the theory must not be true. Well, that's not how science works. It's the theory of evolution, any grand theory like that, is not based on a single fact such that if it turns out it's not true, the whole theory falls. They're based on tens of thousands of facts from dozens or hundreds of different lines of inquiry, different fields that converge to this conclusion. And so what you're witnessing here is really just a different version of the same history that we've had for almost a century now, that is, starting with the Scopes trial in 1925, which tried to get the theory of evolution banned from being taught in public science classes, to the second strategy in the 60s, which was to demand equal time for Darwin and Genesis, and they lost all those cases in court because of the First Amendment. And then the third strategy in the 80s of demanding equal time for creation science and evolution science, both hyphenated. So they just added the word hyphen science to creation and evolution to make it seem like there was an equal balance there to be taught. And they lost that big court case in the United States Supreme Court in 1987 on appeal from the Louisiana Act requiring creation science to be taught. The court, U.S. Supreme Court, voted 7-2 to make it illegal to teach creation science in public classrooms because it's an endorsement of religion. So we all thought, I wrote about the whole chapter on that in my book, Why People Believe Weird Things, and I figured, well, that's the end of that. There's not much more to do on creationism, and I can move on to other areas of work. But in fact, in the 90s, what evolved, so to speak, was something called intelligent design theory, in which they've gotten more clever at designing their arguments, as it were, and trying to find gaps in scientific knowledge that they claim evolutionary biologists cannot explain, and therefore the theory must be in trouble. In fact, no such thing exists. There is no intelligent design science. They're not doing any science. All they're doing is reading science journals, trying to find anomalies that they feel scientists can't explain well, and therefore that's where the intelligent designer intervened into the world. And I think there's a serious problem with pursuing that track if you're a Christian or a believer in general or a Christian in particular, and that is, it's an attempt to naturalize God. It's an attempt to say God is not the God of Abraham, who's omniscient and omnipotent and transcendent and wholly other and so different from the rest of us. In fact, what intelligent design theory says is that God, the intelligent designer, may not even be a God. Maybe it's an advanced, super advanced alien that created life here on Earth. Well, that's just saying that God is like us, but more sophisticated, smarter than us, but like us. And I don't think that's the road that believers really want to go down, but that is the ultimate conclusion to intelligent design theory, is that the intelligent designer is not God in any traditional theological sense, but God is like an alien, or God is an advanced human.
All right. Well, I hope it gets to the question of the caller. We have several others. Next is here someone in Urbana on our line number one. Hello.
Well, you've been hitting so much just now that I'm kind of befuddled as to which to talk about. But
there's a lot there.
Yeah. I think I'll narrow it down to two things here. One is that I'd forgotten about the intelligent design thing and how you're against it. And me personally, I'm not a person who relies on faith. I believe in evidence. So, I don't understand why you don't want to go down. You said why you mentioned why the faith-based people shouldn't go down intelligent design alley, but why don't you want to go down it?
Okay, that's a fair question. I have to say that is a really fair question. And the answer is that because they're not offering any science. There's no testable hypotheses. There's no way to discern whether the thing you're looking at was intelligently designed or designed from the bottom up. We agree that it's designed. The question is, who designed it? Was it natural law, or was it a top-down intelligent designer? And if it's the latter, how did id do it? Did id use natural laws to design it, or supernatural laws? See, in other words, it doesn't add anything to the conversation. It doesn't add anything to what we can do when we're doing science.
Well, one of the theories about how we would finally be able to tell whether there were other intelligent beings in the universe, one idea was that just as on a deserted island, things wash up onto the beach, that one of these days we'd find something that had fallen onto our planet, you know, some debris or something, and I would argue that we would use exactly the same kind of process that these intelligent design people are thinking of to surmise that this was an artifact, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I don't follow your argument.
Well, okay, let's use one of their examples. They take like the eye, and the eye is very complex, and if you took out one or more of the parts, it wouldn't work anymore, and so on. And therefore, it looks, you know, looks intelligently designed. But in fact, the eye has all the earmarks of history, historical design, designed from the bottom up by a tinkerer called natural selection that operates on simpler structures. And the structures become more complex. So you start off, if you look around in nature, you see all kinds of different eyes, simple eye spots, a single cell on skin that's sensitive to light, a whole bunch of patch of cells on skin that are sensitive to light, a pit in the skin in which it's lined with light-sensitive cells, and then sort of a pinhole pupil that creates an image on the back of a crude retina that's filled with light-sensitive cells, and so on. And you see all those different kinds of eyes and many more that I just described in the natural world. So that tells us that that you can have eyes of varying degrees of complexity. And then when we look in the fossil record, we see kind of a sequence of these from simple to complex, and we infer from that eyes, I mean, if you just encountered an eye, like a watch, on the beach, on the island you washed up on, well, of course you'd immediately look at that and go, well, it was designed. But then when you look at the whole grand scope of nature and its complexity and variety of complexity from simple to complex, you realize, oh, well, this evolved from simple to complex. It wasn't just created in a warehouse overnight.
Yeah, but that eventually boils down to the essential question of what is the impetus for getting complex from simple beginnings, and we have no answer for that. And for all we know, it could be designed into existence.
Like gene duplication, for example, can cause trigger an instant increase in information complexity in a genome. So you can go from a simpler genome to a more complex genome simply by duplicating a piece of the chromosome, which happens quite naturally all the time. Scientists have observed this in the laboratory. You can see it happening. And that's one example of how that can happen.
But it's not very explanatory. Doesn't really give any kind of answer. But let me ask you another question, and then I'll hang up.
Okay.
And because I read a lot of your stuff whenever I get a chance. I like your whole organization and things.
Okay.
And one article I remember reading about you that you wrote. Where you talk about your particular theories about you had a purpose, a principle, which I could not quite understand from the article I read. So I thought I'd ask you about it.
Oh, yeah, that's the article I did for American Scientist called The Soul of Science, in which I talked about the evolution of purpose. That is, there's a kind of a move afoot about of Christians talking about the purpose-driven life. There's this book, Purpose-Driven Life. And for Christians, purpose can only come from the top down. You can create your own purpose, but it's hollow compared to a God-driven purpose. And I completely disagree with that. And in any case, what if you don't believe in God or you don't believe in the Christian God? Are you purposeless? I mean, are our lives meaningless? No, absolutely not. We're a social primate species, so much of our purpose derives from helping other people, helping other members of our community. That's very purposeful. In fact, most of the purposes I describe in my article there are the same ones that a Christian would come up with. It's just that we have a different origins of that purpose. So meaningful work, family, a spouse, and children. These are the kinds of activities, helping other people outside of yourself, joining causes and becoming involved with community services and programs, things like that. These are all really good, and they have a perfectly good evolutionary explanation for how we evolved in these small social primate groups, that it's important for us to get along and encourage altruism and cooperation and pro-social behavior. That's what helps the group survive. So I actually argue essentially the same kinds of purposes that a believer would describe, but just a different origin of that purpose.
We have some other callers here, and we'll take those calls. I'm afraid now that we've gotten on the subject of evolution, we won't talk about anything else. But
talk about aliens if you want.
Well, we'll see what's on the mind of the callers. We can give them a chance to direct the conversation. And I think also I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Michael Shermer. He is the publisher of Skeptic Magazine and the executive director of the Skeptics Society, host of the Skeptics Lecture Series at the California Institute of Technology. He's also a columnist for Scientific American. If you're interested in finding out more about the Skeptics Society, they have a website, which is www.skeptic.com. Also, if you're interested in reading some of his columns for Scientific American, you can go then to the Scientific American website, scciam.com/scientificamerican.com, and there you can read his writings for the magazine, and he is also the author of a number of books. You can head out to the bookstore, to the library, to look for them. His most recent is a collection of pieces that he's written over the years. He titles this Science Friction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown, and it's published by Times Books. And we have a number of people here who are interested in getting into the conversation. The next in line is someone in Champaign, I believe, line number 2. Hello.
Yes, here in Champaign. I think one of the origins of the problem that you're identifying comes from our earliest schooling. In the early grades especially, but even through high school these days, although maybe they're trying to change it, even in some college classes they maybe are trying to change it, but school teaches us to look for absolutes. School teaches that if there are four possibilities, one of them and only one of them is the correct one. And
yeah,
I think
right.
That especially since they catch us at that very formative stage of our learning and our mind formation, that those patterns carry with us through into adulthood. And even though if you go to college or if you have life experiences that cause you to challenge your thinking, so many people can't break out of that. They simply have been brainwashed to look for absolutes.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The other thing I wanted to mention...
much to be said on the educational system.
Yes.
That's for sure. I think teaching people that things change, that the answers are not final. I think that that should be a part of education.
Well, and that's the problem. It's not until you get into really advanced advanced grades, and people, again, they just get trained into thinking of that everything is absolute. I think the other half that comes into the educational process is that we're not trained on proper debating techniques. We all argue, but we don't really debate anymore.
Right.
Schools generally don't have debate teams to the extent that they used to. You wouldn't go in it. In town, you don't find an open debate, so, you know, every night or every few nights. I'm thinking of people like Mark Twain and Emerson and people of that age. You know, they would routinely just have open discussions and debates, and people from the town would attend, and everybody would get involved. Now, I think when people resort back to, well, science always comes out with a different finding. You mentioned the whole, you know, do we eat fruit or do we not eat fruit? Are carbs okay or are carbs bad for you? And evolution, of course, is another example. I think people simply are using that as an argument or debate tool to justify their position. It's kind of mental shorthand where it says, you know what, I don't really want to think about it, so I'm looking for an easy escape hatch of this debate.
Yeah, I think you've hit on a key point there. Is it means you don't have to think anymore. I mean, it's what classification systems of knowledge do. Oh, you're an atheist, or you're a feminist, or you're a Democrat, or you're a liberal, or you're a conservative.
Exactly.
I don't have to think about you anymore because I know how you think.
And even in this big debate with Terry Schiavo that we've been hearing the last couple of days, you know, I heard any number of congressmen just simply boil it down to, look, you either have ethics and morals or you don't. If you do, then you should think one way. And if you don't, then you think
the other
way. And so that even in our highest levels of politics, you know, who you'd think people would be fairly well-versed in the skills of debate, but we still fall back on this easy escape hatch. And I think that's a problem that we have to address somehow. It's really not anti-science. It's just simply we're looking for easy ways to not think.
Critical thinking, I think, is what you're after there. We're lacking teaching. I mean, I think debate and disputation and stuff is part of critical thinking, and that's not taught at the lower levels.
Yeah, you know what? You did put your finger on the broader label that does fit even better than just simple debate. So critical thinking is really the skill that is the root of the problem, and at least in my opinion.
Although I think the politicians you described knew perfectly well what they were doing. It's the rest of us watching that are falling for it.
Well, I have to say,
Sunday night watching watching the speeches, I couldn't help but kind of get into it, going, yeah, he's right. And then I had to sit back and think, well, no, wait a minute. That's not that simple.
And, you know,
here I am, Mr. Skeptic, just sort of listening to the rhetoric, falling for it. It's so easy to just fall into that trap.
Well, I was listening to the one guy by the state of Florida who was asked to review 30,000 pages of documents and actually spend days and days of time with Terry Schiavo. And, you know, the conclusions he came up with very different from the politicians who read the headline in the day before's newspaper and made their snap judgment decision. And, again, it's the difference is critical thinking skills.
Yep.
And being able to analyze the data that's out there, not the data that we think is out there or the data that we want to be out there or the data that our political or religious perspective tells us is out there. And, again, that's also part of the critical thinking. The phenomenon that we have about call and radio talk shows, especially the political variety, you know, who listens to them? Well, people with all the same opinions. So who calls into them? People with all the same opinions.
Right, exactly.
And then over-represents the idea that, oh, everybody believes in this. How do we know? Because 10 callers called in today, they all have the same opinion, that my opinion and their opinion must be right. And that's, again, maybe part of that critical thinking.
Here in L.A., we've got Rush Limbaugh and Al Franken on at the same time. So I, in the mornings from 9 to noon, so I when I'm driving around, I like flipping back and forth, just the complete opposite conclusions from the same facts. It's really quite hilarious. It just shows you how subjective politics still is.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right,
I appreciate this conversation.
Thanks for the call. Well, with your conversation here with the caller and also many of the pieces really makes me think about this. A very basic problem that you think about and have written about in your writing and really hear essentially what we've been talking about. And that is that we think that we see things clearly and objectively, but we don't. And in the book, you make some references to some of the ideas of British philosopher Francis Bacon, who was born in 1561. So he did his work some time ago, but he nailed it so beautifully when he said that, our observations of the world are filtered through our brain, and they're influenced by what we think we already know. We're influenced by what other people think. We're influenced or shaped by our ability to describe what we observe. And as I said, I was so impressed when I read that and thought, well, Francis, yeah, I think you got that right, and you got it right a long, long time ago. So obviously we still have the problem now, hundreds of years later.
Yeah, it's an interesting story because Bacon and the rise of the scientific method was a sort of a revolt against Aristotle and the medieval way of using logic and reason only to arrive at truths. And Bacon and his cohort said, no, well, we actually have to go out and look at the world and see what it's really like, not what it's supposed to be like. And often these are two different things, the way we think the world should be and the way it actually is. But Bacon was not naive enough to think that the facts just speak for themselves. We only have to go look. In fact, the facts were filtered through these very subjective brains. And today we call these cognitive biases. My favorite, most powerful one being the confirmation bias. That is, we look for and find confirmatory evidence for what we already believe, and we simply ignore disconfirmatory evidence. Another way to say that is we remember the hits and forget the misses that support or do not support our favorite theories or beliefs. And psychics are very successful with this. People who believe in psychics go to psychics, and they'll get an hour-long reading, and the psychic will say 200 or 300 different comments or questions, and they'll get, half a dozen hits, and the people will only remember the hits and forget all the misses. And in science, we have to remember both the hits and the misses, and conspiracy theories are driven on this confirmation bias. As soon as you think the Jews are running the world, or that Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy, or that 9/11 was orchestrated by Bush and Halliburton and the Jews and Zionism and so on, which is a recent conspiracy theory, by the way. 9/11 was all orchestrated. Then it's easy to kind of go around and just pick out factoids here and there that seem to fit what you believe and just ignore all the rest. And that's what makes conspiracy thinking so dangerous.
Well, let's talk with someone else. Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
How odd it is that people are talking about evolution on this program, David. how could that be?
Darn it, I just don't know.
I'm not going to disappoint you. I want to talk about what evolutionists used to believe, because they used to believe some things that, well, let's just see what they used to believe. They used to believe that garbage generated flies. You had some garbage, you put it out, it would spontaneously generate.
Wait, first of all, what's the relevance of errors that scientists made in the past that scientists themselves corrected? What's the point? Before you go into details, what do you want to
mean? They believe something that's much more outrageous than that now. Now they no longer believe garbage generates life, but they believe DNA with precision sequenced instructions can occur by accident. And now we're talking about precision instructions that would fill a whole set of encyclopedias.
No, not by accident. There's no accidents, really, when we're talking about natural selection. The mutations in genes may be random and accidental, but the actual selection for how they're used is anything but accidental. There's a directional purpose to it.
I'm talking about the original.
And DNA doesn't. We don't start with DNA. DNA was not there at the beginning. We start with something much simpler, something like RNA, which is much simpler than DNA. And probably the original replicators were not even RNA. They're probably even simpler.
Only thing is, we cannot find any form of life, nor can conceive of it, that doesn't use DNA.
For example, mitochondria inside our cells. Well, mitochondria have their own set of DNA. Well, where did mitochondrial DNA come from? Why are there two sets of DNA? And the answer is because mitochondria and the other organelles inside our cells used to be independent cellular organisms themselves, which evolved by cooperating with each other and became larger, more complex cells. And that's how life evolves.
Let's put those in the laboratory and see if they can live by themselves. Let me say this. A fellow by the name of Anthony Flew, a most prominent English atheist from Oxford, he was a champion atheist. And he has admitted DNA and the coherent, the precision instructions in DNA could not occur by accident. He says that's, and he has made big news.
What he said exactly was that intelligent design theory makes me think that there might be some kind of an intelligent designer.
That's
He's
right.
not a Christian. He doesn't believe that there's a Judeo-Christian anthropomorphic God.
Didn't say he did. Didn't say.
All he said was that he's kind of a deist now, that there might be a designer that started the system off, but is no longer involved.
Let's explore the fossil record here. Just a second. The fossil record shows sudden explosion, doesn't show gradual development, shows sudden explosion.
Which
Stephen Jay Gould has said that there are two things you can depend on in the fossil record, that fossils will appear suddenly and fully formed, and that they will remain unchanged.
But even like the Precambrian explosion, the creationist's favorite example, this is not sudden. This is over the course of about 25 million years that these bodies suddenly exploded on the scene. Well, 25 million years is not sudden. That's pretty damn long. When you talk about, say, for example, humans evolved this incredible diversity we have just in the last 100,000 years. Dogs all evolved from a single species of wolves from China in the last 15,000 years. Now, granted, that's partially directed evolution, but that shows how fast evolution can work. In the course of tens of thousands of years, well, 25 million years for the Precambrian explosion, that's plenty of time to get all that diversity.
It is not plenty of time to demonstrate the diversity that you have in the Cambrian. As a matter of fact, you have more phyla, about three times as many phyla in the Cambrian as you have now. It is absurdly too short a time, and that time window is shrinking. In other words, every time we can measure it more accurately, that time period for development becomes less and less.
When you talk about, like, say, the Burgess Shale in British Columbia is 505 million years old, and the Precambrian fossil beds in China that are about 550 million years old, that's 45 million years there where they find fossil transitions from Precambrian to Cambrian. That's a lot of time. Tens of millions of years is plenty of time for evolution to occur.
That time period that you're saying, there are many evolutionists that would disagree with you and say that it's much shorter. But even 45 million years to develop the type of diversity you have in the Cambrian is absurdly too short.
I disagree.
good program, David.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Well, this kind of exchange, I guess, again, makes me go back to the underlying discomfort or lack of satisfaction that people have with the idea, as they would express it, that the kind of diversity of life that we observe now on the planet was, quote, an accident, unquote. It seems like what people really down deep are wrestling with is the idea, well, what's it all for? I mean, if there was no intelligent design, if there was no creator, if it just kind of happened, then doesn't that really mean that there's no purpose for anything?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you grab on for your larger meaning?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's part of one of the misnomers or myths of evolution, that it's a pure accident, chance, randomness, and so on. It's anything but. Evolution is very directed in its selection for certain characteristics to survive. There's nothing random about that. And so I'm arguing in many of my different writings that, in fact, morality evolved, purpose evolved, all the things we think of as unique to humans or that make us very special in the animal kingdom, in fact, have perfectly reasonable evolutionary explanations. But you have to think of evolution not as just random chance. It's not random chance, and no evolutionary biologist would ever say that it is random. It's not random. There might be random things that happen, you know, an asteroid hits the Earth or a mutation in a gene, something like that. But what happens after that is anything but random. It's quite directed.
Do you think that everything can be explained? That's not to say that I don't mean that today everything can be explained, but that ultimately.
I don't know. There's two areas that I tend to think not, and that's the free will determinism question and the God question. I think ultimately science cannot adjudicate those two questions. Now, I hope I'm wrong, but the people a lot smarter than me have been debating this, philosophers and scientists and so on, for thousands of years. And the free will determinism one in particular, I just think has no ultimate resolution. It's just that you just decide how it is you feel about it, and then you act accordingly. And I mean, you know. So anyway, that, I'd say those two areas.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with some more folks here. The next is Urbana, line 3.
Hello. Yes, I like the way William Jennings Bryan characterized the evolution debate in his defense of the teacher who taught creationism in the Scopes trial, and that he said, you believe in the ages of rocks, I believe in the rock of ages.
Yeah, that's a great line.
Yes.
And religion teaches us how to go to heaven, and science teaches us how the heavens go.
Yeah.
So if you want to think of science and religion as really two different spheres, then they're not really in conflict in that sense.
Uh-huh. My question is, if evolution is correct, then where is the missing link? That is, half man, half ape.
Oh, there's tons of them, lots. The fossil record for hominids is quite good now. It's a very bushy bush, lots of twigs.
Where would
just in the last half million years, we have half a dozen different species, at least, if not more, of hominids that were living simultaneously with us that have all gone extinct. We're the last man standing, so to speak. So the old missing link argument is really, it's gone now. There's so many transitional fossils.
Where could I research that for my own satisfaction?
Oh, a terrific new book by Richard Dawkins called The Ancestor's Tale, T-A-L-E.
Oh, yeah.
Ancestor's Tale has a ton of stuff in there. In fact, it has transitional fossils, so to speak, all the way back to the very beginning, the first cells. It's kind of a long book, but it's a beautiful narrative. It's a nice read. It's like reading a novel, but it's a novel about the history of life, so to speak. And so there's tons of stuff there.
Uh-huh.
You can go to our webpage, skeptic.com. We have quite a bit of stuff on evolution. That's you know, there's plenty of transitional fossils.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you.
All right. Let's go to another Urbana caller. This is line 1. Hello.
Yes. Wonderful show. The person who brought up the question of critical thinking, I thought, was extremely interesting. It's not taught in the schools, and neither is rebellion, or we would not have Red Lakes and Columbines. The children learn rebellion through the media, which also teaches them middle-class values. Violence, guns, serve yourself, and screw your buddy. Now, in the question is, that's the comment, I'd like you to give us a thumbnail description of why Professor Freud, one of the great scientific minds of the early 20th century, has been turned on by the scientific community, and does this relate to metaphysics and idealism, opposed to the materialism of the scientific thinkers? Not dialectics, I should say, idealism and metaphysics.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I happen to be one of those scientists that doesn't think much of Freud. The reason most scientists don't think much of Freud is because he was wrong. He either created non-testable hypotheses, and he was doing literature, not science, or ideology, not science, or what he did create that was kind of pseudoscience or partial science turned out to be wrong. So there's not much to say about Freud. He was famous, basically, and that's why his influence. He was first on the scene for really trying to found a science of psychology, and therefore his legacy is lasting. Unfortunately, his legacy is wrong. I mean, of the big three, Darwin, Marx, and Freud, only Darwin is left standing. Marx was wrong. Marx was completely wrong about the class system and that there would only be two classes, the haves and have-nots, and the have-nots would revolt. And so he's completely wrong about that. And socialism doesn't work. Communism doesn't work. It's completely contrary to human nature. And we've had, you know, a century of social experiments that have shown that Marx is wrong. Same thing with Freud. The only one left standing is Darwin. He turned out to be right, largely. I mean, there's neo-Darwinism and revisionism of Darwinism and so on, but the core basis of Darwinian theory is still there because it survived all these tests.
We have as our guest in this point of Focus 580 Dr. Michael Shermer. He's a columnist for Scientific American. He has authored many books, including Why People Believe Weird Things, How We Believe, and the Science of Good and Evil. He's publisher of Skeptic Magazine, executive director of the Skeptic Society. His newest book is a collection of his writings over the years. It's titled Science Friction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown. It's published by Times Books. And we have another caller here in line, and we probably could get in maybe one more at least, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. This caller is in Champaign in line 2. Hello.
Hi, fascinating program. I don't mean to get picky, but You do accept the idea that perhaps the American, the French, the Chinese, and the Russian revolutions were all caused by somewhat confused but open conspiracies, I would presume. That's correct.
Oh, yeah, sure. Conspiracies exist, absolutely.
Okay, now, the reason why I called was because when you're talking American paranoid conspiracy fanaticism, for a long time, the Lincoln assassination, which was known at the time to be the result of a very confused conspiracy,
uh-huh.
was termed the acts of a one single madman. And then the same thing with JFK's assassination.
Yeah, I agree with you. Lincoln was killed by a conspiracy, no doubt about it.
They even had a song out comparing the two assassinations.
Well, I used to think Kennedy, JFK was a conspiracy, and then I read a book called Case Closed by Gerald Posner. It's a great book. This guy really did his homework. And he lined up every single point by the conspiracy theorists and knocked them down one by one and showed Oswald acted alone. And I'm back to the lone assassin theory.
Well, that's fascinating. Not to get picky, but as a parting remark, I'd like to point out that China did not exist 15,000 years ago. Even most Chinese, I presume, would agree with that.
Oh, yeah, okay. Wolves evolved from an area currently called China.
All right. See, that you got to watch yourself. There are people out there taking notes.
Good audience. Smart listeners you have there, Dave.
Well, yes, indeed. I think so, too. Let's go to another Champagne person. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a public school teacher on spring break listening to your program, and just wanted to correct your previous caller who said that critical thinking skills were not taught in the school. That is not the case. They are taught from kindergarten through 12th grade. It's a very important strategy.
Oh, wonderful to hear that.
Oh, absolutely. In the teacher education programs, all teachers are trained that way, and us old-timers are retrained to incorporate that in our teaching, and it's vital in every subject area. I'm a fine arts teacher, and every day we're doing critical thinking skills.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And again, somebody wants to call real quick, we can get maybe one more caller, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Back again to, I guess, again, one of the sort of fundamental questions that you deal with in the book is how it is that we know anything about anything. And I think you would say that that science certainly can help, although with the kind of qualifications that we've placed on it, that even scientists would say that there rarely is there a final answer. And what we think we know today could indeed be, we could be proven wrong. After all, you can do an experiment 100 times and get the same result. All it takes is one time when you get something else for you to say, well, maybe there's a problem with what we thought we knew. What is it that you would like people, though, to know about science? How would you think you would like them to think about science?
I think that it's a system, a method, a process, not a thing. It's a verb, not a noun. It's just a way of approaching the world. And it works. It works really well. If you want to send a spacecraft to Mars, you use science. You use astronomy. You don't use astrology. That's fundamentally what makes science different from all these other traditions, is that it works. And it's very pragmatic. And it's a very workable, pragmatic way of thinking about the world.
Hmm. How, well, this is a related question, I guess. We seem to not be very good at talking about, and I'm talking about in the public sphere, you know, in the public square, talking about issues that have to do with science and technology. We seem not to be very good about it, and I don't know if that has to do with people feeling uncomfortable with science or not, that they don't quite understand it, or maybe the media does a poor job of exploring the issues. Do you think that there are some things that we could do to get better so that we can involve more people and we could have a better discussion that has to do with scientific issues, technology issues, particularly when it comes down to when we're going to make the decision about adopting some sort of new technology, and we want to weigh the advantages, the disadvantages, not do the kind of a gee whiz thing that we often do and latch onto something and then sometime later start thinking about whether or not that was a good idea.
Yeah, I think more open debate involving scientists, and scientists should be more accessible. The media should approach and access scientists more often. I think we need our own equivalent of C-SPAN just for science. In fact, I'm on the board of a group called Cable Science Network, in which we want to do just that. We haven't been able to raise the money yet, but basically we have on the books a C-SPAN equivalent of science. It would be science 24/7, 365. And we would debate, like, stem cells. And you'd have all the great scientists doing work in stem cells, for and against and so on, or abortion or right to life, you know, all the medical / scientific issues involved in those political religious debates. So that we don't just watch the congressmen debating it who have political agendas and are not scientists, but we also have scientists involved. So I think I'd like to see more of that sort of thing.
Well, we will have to stop because we've come to the end of our time. Our guest, Michael Shermer, is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, director of the Skeptics Society, and also monthly columnist for Scientific American, author of a number of books and his most recent, Science Friction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown. It's published by Times Books. Mr. Shermer, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.